to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being
held.
Can't
get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We would just first like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And now on to the story we're going to be covering today. Earlier this month, the Writers Guild of America, or the WGA, and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, or the AMPTP, which is the industry group that represents the executives of major Hollywood studios as well as the streaming platforms, those two groups failed to reach a deal on a minimum bargaining agreement by the May 1st deadline, which led to the Writers Guild to call for their first strike since 2007.
Mm-hmm. And the main issues at play here are pay scales, residual fees, and base employment guarantees.
Yeah, and upon calling for a strike, the WGA released a statement to its members that explained, quote, "Though we negotiated intent on making a fair deal, the studio's response to our proposals have been wholly insufficient. Given the existential crisis that we're facing, the company's behavior has created a gig economy inside a union workforce, and their immovable stance in this negotiation has betrayed a commitment to further devaluing the profession of writing. They have taken so much from the very people, the writers, who have made them wealthy. But what they cannot take from us is each other, our solidarity, our mutual commitment to save ourselves and this profession that we love. We had hoped to do this through reasonable conversation. Now we will do it through struggle." Powerful words there from the representatives of the writers themselves. To those of us outside the entertainment industry, writing for television and movies certainly seems like one of the most exciting, desirable, and lucrative careers that you could imagine. However, it's important to understand that the people working in that profession aren't simply creatives and artists realizing their childhood dreams. They're also people who get up every day and go to work at their highly demanding and increasingly precarious jobs.
And I think it's important to remember as well that like a lot of other professions, the people at the top aren't representative of the industry as a whole. And in order to kind of have this entire, you know, Hollywood industry that we have, there's also, for every blockbuster, there's also smaller movies that need to get written. And like many other jobs across the country, it's getting harder and harder for those across all those tiers to make a living as a writer. Even those who are getting work, right, it's not easy for them.
Yeah, that level of lucrative stardom is functionally a lottery. You know, consider for acting, like for every Chris Pratt or Chris Hemsworth or Chris Pine, there are 1,000 other successful and talented Chris's who get work but, you know, really struggle to make ends meet, and, you know, who we've never actually heard of before. 98% of writers who participated in the WGA authorization vote voted in favor of striking. And they did so in large part to ensure that working on a streaming service pays out in a manner closer to traditional TV and closer to the way previous generations of writers, directors, and actors fought for years to achieve. Writers, as well as most actors and directors, get paid far less in residuals than the handful of A-list names at the top of the industry.
Mm-hmm. And residuals, for everybody listening, is the term used to refer to money paid to folks who worked on a piece of media when it gets repackaged, resold, or re-aired. Syndication, yeah, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why, you know, with syndication, it used to be a big deal to get your show syndicated. Getting to the point where your show was being aired on, say, TBS or Comedy Central meant that you were sharing in the profits and success of the show and getting guaranteed repeated checks for years to come. And, you know, unsurprisingly, it took decades of struggle in order to set in place a system that ensured creatives this level of profit sharing from their work.
Mm-hmm. But that level of financial security has basically largely evaporated. Streaming services pay single fixed residuals that aren't tied to viewer numbers, and there's no additional payment that comes when shows shuffle between different streaming services.
Yeah.
And I think this is like a primary example of an industry kind of changing shape or form, but not changing the inputs, right? Like they still request the same inputs,
yeah,
are changing the way it's structured and its outputs, and then kind of basically putting the onus,
yeah,
you know, on those inputs to go deal with this change, right? Like, hey, exactly, we're disrupting this industry, deal with it.
Yeah.
But right, it can only exist because of some of the inputs that have been set up from the old way of doing things, right?
Yeah, it is very much like a, hey, we're disrupting this, deal with it, but we're not going
to. But also we need it. You to stay exactly doing exactly what you were doing before.
Yeah, you stay exactly as you were, we'll change everything else.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, there's an example that I saw online where a writer recently shared pictures of residual checks that she received for writing two episodes of Jane the Virgin, which were for, you know, just 1 and 2 cents respectively.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like the system itself that was put in place over years of struggle has, yeah, really largely been left, you know, in the dust by like the changing streaming, yeah, service.
And obviously on this show, we don't like to dive into like the stock market in particular and kind of what is driving these things, right? But I think it's important context for the listeners to kind of understand that, you know, the stock market is changing and investors are changing what they see valuable in companies.
Yeah.
And growth, right? A company like Netflix that is burning billions of dollars to make shows just to grow, that is no longer kind of the peak of what investors are looking for,
yeah,
right? They're looking for profitability. They're also looking for margins, right? And I think companies can really create a lot of extra margin by reducing a lot of their headcount and their HR and their actual people.
Yeah.
And so this is just another way, right, of, you know, an industry changing its stripes and then also trying to meet the demands of the market and the stock market and things like this, and right, who's getting squeezed out? It's, again, what do you know, the union folks.
Yeah, shocking. Yeah, I think that's a good point, because it's important to realize that so much of this is being driven by the fact that like these companies are profitable, but their demands are largely coming from like Wall Street investors and not from like the sound, you know, not the system they've set up of like subscription based
mm-hmm.
Growth that they have, but rather from like the demand for increased profitability.
Well, and again, I think a lot of it's margins.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't touched on this show, but, you know, Vice Media is shuttering the doors in a lot
That's
of
right.
major areas.
Yeah.
And they had very profitable websites that were operating on subscription models from viewers making millions of dollars a year. But again, if you have, you know, 16, 17 people and you're making that amount of money, the margins aren't enough for the market to be interested in you.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a shifting kind of economic market. And it's kind of leading to some decisions that are a little bit counterintuitive.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's unfortunate. And it's, again, as we've, you know, pointed out endlessly, like this is not the only industry where this happens. This is sort of what the financialization of all of our industries has mm-hmm. led to, is that like it's driven by what the investors demand rather than like what the sound principles of that company set in place.
Yeah.
You know, and it's important to recognize that like the last time the WGA went on strike was in 2007, so like over a decade ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and streaming at that point was like a nascent technology.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and obviously, you know, we'll close out the economic portions of this, yeah, to kind of keep us focused on the union part. But again, right, the way these streaming services disrupted TV is they really got rid of the ads.
Yeah.
And the problem is that ads are actually how a lot of these people were paid and how the industry itself made money.
Yeah.
And so when you remove the growth aspect, you remove the new investment because growth isn't as interesting. Now these companies are kind of left holding their own bag that they've made in that they have to have a high margin, profitable business that really on its face wasn't even designed to do that.
Right.
Right. And so it's we're kind of in this thing where they've disrupted, they've created, but they didn't actually have a plan or foresee kind of these market changes, and so we kind of end up in these situations where people are being paid less and less to basically make up for a model that doesn't quite make mathematical sense.
That didn't have like a long-term vision for it.
Well, and we're, you know, obviously we're partly to blame here as consumers, and a lot of people don't want ads, right? And we're kind of shifting away from it.
No one likes
it. But it's kind of how everything was free and how it costed what it costed was because we watched advertisements for it.
Yeah. Like the trade-off for being able to stream all of the episodes of, you know, your favorite show without commercials is the fact that like these companies now, I mean, we're seeing it with like Netflix, you know, recently they've had so many headlines about having to crack down
shows,
on sharing.
Right? Yeah, show's doing really well, but guess what? It's not a blockbuster, so it's gone.
Yeah.
Right? Like we're only doing things that are going to increase our subscription count and things like that. And you'll see too, you know, I think we all are consumers of streaming services, a lot of them are pivoting to basic packages that are cheaper with ads. And so we're basically back to cable because the business model that they've basically invented wasn't making sense. And when you take the growth away, you take the investment away, you take the hype away.
Yeah. It's kind of the classic tech disruption cycle of like, oh, they disrupt an industry, get it to the point where, okay, well, we now are at the point where we can't just have unlimited growth. So what do? Oh, we reinvent the thing that we disrupted in the first place.
I mean, you're seeing it right now, which, I mean, not to go here, but you're seeing it right now with generative AI.
Yes.
We're being resold search engines.
Yep.
Just in a different form and in a lot of times more like less accurate.
Yeah.
So, you know, you definitely got to keep an eye on these guys.
And it's interesting you bring that up because it's actually an issue that we'll get into in a moment here about that like is actually part of what the writers are striking about. And so, yeah, the last time that the writers went on strike, streaming was in its infancy. And as such, it was a major point of contention in the negotiations. And this is because every time distribution technology changes, writers have had to strike to make sure that they're fairly compensated. In fact, you know, the very first WGA strike took place in 1960, and it resulted in writers getting a share of profits when a movie was aired on TV. While a 1973 strike focused in on part of the emerging market, you know, of cable. And of course, in their 1980s, in the 1980s, they saw a series of strikes over the transition to home video. Mm-hmm. And as a result of the 2007 strike, the most recent one, the WGA ensured that, you know, quote, new media, which is basically anything distributed online, was covered by the Guild's collective bargaining agreement, which is referred to as the Minimum Basic Agreement, or the MBA. And that sets the floor for how little studios are allowed to pay writers for their work. And in the 15 years since that strike, we have seen an explosion in TV production largely tied to the streaming services, meaning that more and more writers are doing work that pays worse and worse and is less secure. Now, this same philosophy is behind another newer practice the writers are opposing, known as, quote, mini rooms. Now, these mini rooms are essentially writers' rooms with fewer writers contracted for shorter periods of time. On these kinds of jobs, fewer writers work for less time and lower pay in a fashion that is far less connected to the eventual finished series or movie.
Yeah, and if you see someone describing the studios as attempting to turn writing into gig work, this is partly what they're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and worse still, it means fewer writers are able to get the experience that actually allows them to advance their careers and eventually become showrunners themselves. You know, as a natural condition of their job, generally, writers have traditionally been able to observe the ins and outs of the industry, including like visiting sets, interacting with directors and actors, and participating in the editing process. But as a result, they gain, you know, as a result of that, they gain more experience and eventually become capable of running the shows themselves. To give just one example, we would never have gotten The Sopranos had David Chase not spent years writing for shows like Rockford Files and the Northern Exposure.
Mm-hmm. Squeezing production tighter and reducing opportunities for advancement means that over time, there will be fewer and fewer people capable of actually making the media that studios need to be able to fill all of these streaming services.
Yeah, and that means, you know, from a consumer's perspective, that means that the quality of the shows and movies that are available to us are going to see a market decline. And in place of the built-in experience that came with the old employment model, the studios have begun offering a lottery-based, you know, unpaid internship opportunities for writers to visit the sets that of the series that they work on, which seems insane. If you're writing the scripts for these shows, you should be able to be there to represent the writing to the people that are then putting it to the actors. But instead, it's like a lottery-based system to see if you're lucky enough to get to go visit the set. These new types of writer rooms also put limitations on the finished product in the present. You know, as an example, I've seen shared a lot recently is that the new Netflix series Beef, in their mini room, it actually finished. They finished working before they got to write the season finale, and that meant that the show's creator was left to write the last episode of the series alone, while also overseeing production of that of the series. So, you know, even if these working conditions seem abstract to us lay people, you know, us viewers, it's clear that they're having a serious impact on the lives of the writers employed under them and on the quality of the shows that they're creating and, you know, that we get to actually watch. Now, just as streaming has been for the past 15 years, emerging technologies will continue to be a tool for companies seeking to reduce the amount that they pay their workers, or, you know, a means for them to get rid of their workers entirely. During the contract negotiations, the most recent ones, the WGA proposed regulating the use of so-called generative AI in writers' rooms by, you know, first by preventing AI from writing or changing material covered by their minimum basic agreement.
And also preventing it from being used as source material from adaptations.
Yeah. And finally, by ensuring that the guild material can't be used to train these programs to then write those AI-generated scripts. The executives countered that offer by offering to hold annual meetings to discuss advances in technology. But that, of course, is a very nebulous mm-hmm. concept that doesn't actually lead to concrete, you know, bargaining chips. So in a world where AI was able to produce, you know, anything resembling a script, that would only be because it had been fed the work of hundreds of other writers who would no doubt go uncompensated for that work. And, you know, besides, what viewers want out of entertainment is a type of originality and creative spark that really can only come from the human mind. I think a great case in point on this is all of the confusing and really unnerving AI-generated ads that we've seen passed around the internet recently for things like, you know, beers and you know, Pizza Hut-style restaurants that end up having, you know, scripts that are sort of human but really kind of complicated and it, you know, it doesn't have any type of creative spark or anything that might lead the viewer to want to watch the next episode. Mm-hmm. The technology is not quite there, but it certainly could get to that point in the near-term future.
And I think the work in which the generative AI is basically basing its like content off of, I think, is also a very underrated and massive point here.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we are going to be using AI going forward, not only who is compensated for how the AI learns, but then also who owns and is able to use in the future the work that it generates.
Right.
Especially when, you know, if you do a more niche one, right? A lot of these like ChatGPT models, they're reading the entire internet. But I'm assuming if an AI is created to, you know, do writing for shows like this, it's going to be looking at shows that are similar.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, how the AI is trained, how it learns, right, how its probability model actually leads to an output of a script. All of these things are going to involve people who in the past would have gotten basically syndication money for these things, right? Like, if you're basing a new show off the work that I've done as a writer,
yeah,
then really you ought to, you know,
you should get residuals.
Yeah,
for that. It's crazy.
So
yeah,
really, I think this is going to be a massive, massive, massive point.
Yeah.
Both, but you know, for the WGA and also for other folks who are, yeah, you know, going to battle AI kind of in the future. And again, I think it has massive potential to help us, but we have to kind of make sure we're doing it in a right way. That, you know, as we get more efficient, we're still kind of acknowledging the work that it takes to get there.
Yeah, it is interesting that this is kind of the first front on the battle between workers and AI taking over those jobs. Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, we haven't talked about it on the show too, but I mean, there's been, you know, I've read articles about a Wendy's opening up a fully entirely automated one, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, this is going to affect more than just creative online work. This is physical, you know, there's AIs taking up physical space, yeah, doing things, right? And especially like being able to take an order or things like that. This is a very real thing that's happening. And honestly, we don't know if the AI is really ready to even handle these things, right? I think it's one thing to try to replace jobs with it. I think it's another to do it and then have it not go well and not acknowledge it and then backpedal, right? Yes. That's the part that I think we're less capable of as like a corporate state. And so I think too, right, making sure the AI is in a place that it's ready to do the things that the tech companies say that it can.
Right.
Because again, we've been waiting for self-driving cars for about a decade. And so, you know, we can't always trust the sellers of these tools to basically represent them in a meaningful manner that is accurate to their ability.
And exactly, because they'll never point out the pitfalls of it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, just to bring back what I was talking about before, like the AI generated like commercials and things that people have been passing around as like examples of like, well, you know, actors and directors are screwed with this. I mean, those are such garbage versions of, you know, the actual, even like CGI movies where you have like people with extra fingers and people standing through walls and stuff like that. Like clearly the technology is not there for either like the production of visuals or for writing yet.
But also even if it was, regardless of the execution of the AI, it still is learning from things that were written by people at the end of the day. We're not making AIs and then those AIs are feeding other generative AIs. We're basing the work off the work of human beings.
Exactly.
And so kind of regardless of its level of execution, how realistic these things come out, we still have to address that point. And I think that's something the WGA will absolutely be talking about and fighting for probably for the next decade plus.
Yeah, this is very clearly like the next frontier for the struggle that the WGA will have to take on, both the, you know, the Hollywood-based WGA, but also WGA East, where they cover largely like, you know, magazine and literary writers and stuff like that. So this is clearly an issue that writers everywhere will have to be confronting. And it's great that the WGA has really taken this on in this battle.
Clearly, right, like, you know, we talk a lot about, obviously you can indirectly connect this AI stuff to money and salary, but also, right, like we talk about so much that these strikes and these kind of fights for equality and kind of representation, they're not always just salary based, right? They want to preserve a way of creating and doing things that, while yes, they are a part of, is also this massive, gigantic, breathing, growing thing.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, obviously we want to incorporate technology to everything that we do, but it has to be done in a way that makes sense and kind of allows us to grow in a more natural manner and things like that. So again, it's not always just purely salary a lot of the times, right? Whether it's the teacher strike in Chicago that we covered years ago or this, right? It's not always money. There's industry level things that I think a lot of unions fight for.
Yeah, because like in an ideal setting or an ideal vision of it, like this technology could actually make the jobs of writers easier.
Yeah, we could make more content more quickly. It's efficiency.
Yeah, like they could still be the ones inputting the information that the AI then spits out like the basic text of or whatever, but that's just not as in the, you know, the track record of how our society and our economy integrates this stuff. We know it just squeezes workers.
No, it's let's cut 70% of the workforce and then make the 30 pick up the slack for the AI writing things that don't make sense, right? And then
now you're kind of,
you're back to basically people being overworked and it not making sense.
So it's kind of the exact same thing we covered a few months ago about the, you know, the railroads shrinking the number of people, workers on each train and making them just cover more safety inspections, and that leads to derailments.
Yes.
It's, you know, this is not the exact same, but it is very much the same theme.
Vein,
here.
Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. Just for some perspective, you know, WGA member Adam Conover, who is also the host of the Adam Ruins Everything show, put it in pretty stark terms in a recent CNN interview. He explained that the thousands of writers on strike are asking for roughly the same amount that Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav took home just last year alone, you know? The explosion in TV production has been a rising tide, but that tide has only lifted the boats of studios and investors, writers along with, you know, actors and below-the-line crew, and anyone else who doesn't see the fruits of these historic profits have been, you know, essentially left to drown in that rising tide. You know, the writers aren't the only people whose undervalued work makes the entertainment industry possible. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or the IATSE, which represents many of the people in crew roles on these sets, only narrowly avoided a strike in 2021 by exploiting quirks in their voting system.
Yeah, and the Screen Actors Guild and the Directors Guild of America have contracts that are expiring soon.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how they take on some of these issues once mm-hmm. those contracts expire as well. You know, with thousands of people walking the picket lines in the first couple weeks of this strike, the solidarity and determination on display has been staggering. Writers on late night shows join writers for scripted series, as well as allies from organized musicians, actors, and crew, and even some more high-profile picketers, such as Natasha Lyonne, Rob Lowe, Gina Gershon, Cynthia Nixon, Kerry Washington, Jason Sudeikis, Seth Meyers, and Fred Armisen, and so many more. You know, in fact, in a recent interview given while marching with his fellow TV Saul character, Bob Odenkirk, actor Manny Patinkin went so far as to even call for an all-out general strike, saying, quote, "I believe all unions should be in solidarity. No one should go back to work until everyone has an equitable, fair wage and dignity to their lives." And when asked about it during a red carpet interview at this year's Met Gala, Amanda Seyfried told a Variety reporter, quote, "Everything changed with streaming, and everyone needs to be compensated for their work. It's blank easy. It's bleeping easy. I don't get it," end quote. And even President Biden showed solidarity or showed support during a recent press conference by saying, quote, "I sincerely believe the strike gets resolved and writers are given a fair deal as soon as possible. This is an iconic, meaningful American industry, and we need the writers and all the workers to tell the stories of our nation and the stories of all of us," you know, end quote. So the fight seems likely to continue for some time, you know, especially since the first big chunk of WGA leverage over the fall broadcast season won't really be, you know, seriously threatened for a few more weeks. But the writers aren't going anywhere. They've proven that they're going to be out in the picket lines, and there's more people coming to join them, you know, by the day, and more industries showing solidarity. And as WGA members said repeatedly in the lead up to the strike, the demands they're making are existential. You know, they are facing an existential crisis mm-hmm. for the career of writing. So really, it's just a question of how long it takes the studios to realize that and to treat their workers with the equity and respect that they deserve. We are running out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. But we will definitely keep an eye on this story and can, you know, bring you updates to this as a new contract is negotiated, or if, you know, workers are still out on strike the next time we are back with you next month. But for now, thank you so much for tuning into Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Ellie Gilland.
Have a wonderful evening.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people. another part of personality is the way other people affect you.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
Baby, you understand me now.
Will be